It has been an interesting morning this morning. Just before service started, my wife was usually at the Welcome Center in the back. She wasn't here. She's kind of unusual. And Pastor Brian got a call because she didn't want to bother me. But my daughter had spun off the road on her way to church today. She's fine. I think she's sitting here. So I didn't know how things were exactly, other than my wife was on her way there and took care of it, and the police came and drug her out of wherever she needed to, and back on the road, minor plastic damage on the car. So then I come in here just as I kind of find out that things are okay, so I'm a little flustered, and then we have a video, and then that crashes. Video system completely crashes. So then I use the iPad that I usually have. That crashes. So at one point, I kind of gave up for service altogether. But then afterwards, service was over. And, you know, when your kid kind of goes through an experience like that, you just kind of want to hug them. You know, you just want to make sure, you know, everything's okay. So I'm in the sound booth trying to fix our video thing that I never did get fixed. And I'm back there, and she comes up to me, and I'm like, oh, you're okay. And she says, you owe me 20 bucks. In my family, we've had a long-standing rule. You rarely hear me give illustrations about my children and my family from up front, because it's their private lives, not for public display always. But sometimes it's really beneficial, and I want to tell a story that has to do with my kids or something from my family. My rule with the kids is that if I mention you from up front, I owe you 20 bucks. That way, it reminds me, be very careful if you use your kids, because it's going to cost you 20 bucks. Secondly, they don't feel so bad about it because they get paid. So I wasn't even going to mention her this service, but since I'm already paying for it, what else can I tell about Casey? If you made $1 million, would you be rich? Everybody wants to be a millionaire, right? Well, that might have meant something a few years ago than what it does today, but it's still not chump change, right? I mean, $1 million is still $1 million. It's a lot of money. Would you be rich if you had $1 million? Or maybe this question, are you rich? Anyone here today rich? Don't show your hands. Are you rich? What is rich? The average income level in South Dakota for a household, you know what it is? Average household income? 50 grand. It's just shy. The latest census. About $50,000 for a household. Now, with this average, if your household makes $50,000 a year, that means in 20 years, your household would make $1 million. So most of you that have been working for about 20 years, your household, you're millionaires. How's it feel? In your lifetime, you'll make about $2.5 million. Average South Dakota household. I think you're all pretty rich as a result of that. But what is rich? Most people define rich. This sounds silly, but it's not. Most people define rich as any person that makes more money than they do. Would you resonate with that? I mean, I know it sounds wrong, but it kind of feels right, doesn't it? And people that are rich just make more than me. If you make more than me, you're rich. I wish I was where you were at. You have more money than me, you're rich. I may not be poor, but I'm certainly not rich because you make more, so you're the person who's rich. Take it this way. Think of your first job you ever had. If at that first job you made what you make today, like you just walked in the door and said, what's the salary? And they told you what you're currently making today, would you think you were rich then? Yeah. Well, maybe some of you are like, no, it's been downhill for me ever since. But then are you rich today? There's a perspective piece to this. The dictionary defines rich as this: having a great deal of money or assets. This is the dumbest definition I think I've come across in a long time. What does great deal mean? it still does not define rich. A great deal of money or assets. Well, my perception of great deal could be very different from your perception of what a great deal of assets or possessions or money might be. Okay, look. Let's take someone who's working in their first job. Now, when I say first job, I don't mean like the kind of jobs that I have at my house for my kids, where if you mow the lawn, you get $4. I know that's slave labor, but I don't care. It's my house. I mean the kind of job where Social Security is taken out. You know, your taxes are taken out. You pay taxes after that first year, that job. In South Dakota, the least you can be paid in that kind of a job is minimum wage, which is how much per hour? $8.50. $8.50 is minimum wage here in South Dakota. So, if you work minimum wage, and you work 40 hours a week like the rest of everybody else, at the end of the year, you will have $17,680. That's minimum wage, full-time work. If you make minimum wage and you make $17,680 per year, you are in the top 5% of wage earners in the world. 95% of the world's population makes less than you do. If you're in the top 5% of wage earners in the world, would you be rich? Well, prior to that statistic, I would have thought so. Isn't that kind of crazy? You're in the top 5% if you make minimum wage and work full-time in South Dakota. The average worker in Indonesia makes 39 cents per hour. And that's the average, not the lowest paid. The average in Indonesia is 39 cents per hour. It takes that person 23 years to make your income if you make minimum wage and work full-time. It takes them 23 years to earn that much money, $17,680. If you're making minimum wage, you know how long it takes during your 8-hour shift to earn enough to buy a can of Coke? 4 minutes. If you're making minimum wage, it takes 4 minutes for you to earn enough for a can of Coke. Well, five if you have to pay your taxes first, but let's say $4. Someone in Ghana, it takes them 7 hours to buy that same can of Coke. What is rich? I guess let's boil it down to this. Will you ever have enough? Is there ever a limit? You ever say, I'm good, I don't need any more. I have all that I need. I have more than enough. Does that place ever come for us? I mean, think of that first job that you had. If you ended up getting the paycheck that you have today, you probably would have said, yeah, I've got, this is more than I need, obviously. But somehow over time, that amount doesn't seem to meet our needs. And it really doesn't matter how much we get, it will never meet our needs. Maybe needs is the wrong word. Our wants, our desires. It's hard to even determine what needs are anymore. We don't even really feel needs when it comes to, like, you know, the basics. This coming Friday is going to be a very sobering illustration of the truth that in America there is never enough. People are going to go out on Good Friday and then they're going to go crazy. Well, you know, it's not even Good Friday anymore. You start on Thanksgiving now. I mean, they've bumped it up right into the holiday. I mean, you throw the turkey on the table and out the door you go. You got to hit the deals. It's not that the deals are a bad deal, but, oh, sorry, I said Good Friday. Black Friday. Wrong holiday. Yeah, there's a theological problem in that statement. Black Friday, thank you. Because at Black Friday, it's about getting. And if we're honest with ourselves, we probably don't need most of what we would be purchasing. In fact, we probably don't need a lot of what we purchase on a day-to-day basis. For most Americans, we have more stuff that fits in our than fits in our house. And so we have things that are crammed in every nook and cranny, and then we have bags and boxes of stuff that we've purchased that we don't have room for. And so what do we decide to do? Well, we do some cleaning and some organizing, and we pull stuff out, and this is all good products, but they're ones that we've deemed are the less beneficial ones in our house, and so we put them in boxes and bags, and we haul them down to Goodwill, because somebody else could probably use this stuff, or we have a garage sale, whatever it may be, and we dump off this stuff. which opens up some room in the house so all the stuff in the bags and boxes can now be crammed into that space. And then the bedroom or the place where these boxes were all of a sudden feels kind of empty, and you're like, hey, I can go shopping again. And we go and we buy more stuff. And we buy and we store and we sell and we give away and we buy more. And there's this never-ending consumption for us. So there's never really an end to what we think that we want or think that we need. It's hard to know what a need is anymore because we have so much. You see, clothing isn't just about covering our body, but it's about style or design or brand. It's not just about food for consumption, for caloric intake, but it's food for an entirely different reason. In my home, there are certain individuals, oh, I've already paid you, Casey, will stand in front of the refrigerator. And she'll open it up, and she'll open, we have a side-by-side, fridge and freezer. Open it up, look inside, and in my refrigerator and freezer, I have more food than some families have for an entire month in this world. More food than maybe they see in many, many months. But my kids can look in that refrigerator and stand there, and I just see the dollar signs pouring out in the cold air. And what do they say? You have that too? Yeah, there's nothing to eat in here. What are we really saying? Wow. Like the level of like hunger is low in my family. There's more than enough. There's plenty of food to eat, but it's food isn't about caloric intake, but it's saying something different. It's meeting a need. There's a desire that I have, a want that I have. Have you ever done that with food? We're going to cover what sounds good. What's going to feel chips? No. Marshmallows? No. Chocolate, graham crackers? Boy, if someone would build a bonfire, that'd be perfect, you know? What, you know, and all of a sudden you hone in on it, right? Pringles, that's it, you know, and you devour the can. It's different than just food. Needs are hard for us to identify because we hardly can tell what a need is anymore. We just are driven by our wants and our desires. It is not bad to have. Having is not bad. Having becomes a problem when it removes our dependence on God. Having is not good when it removes our dependence on what God can provide for us. When we can write the check, I don't need God. I don't need God's provision. I don't need God. I mean, I pray for the food, but I don't know why, because I got plenty in there for months. I don't need God to provide for me on a daily basis. I can write my own check. I can do my own thing. I don't even need God for health, because I have health insurance, and I've got everything. I mean, I don't need to lean on him for any particular thing. When my desire or my accumulation of stuff gets in the way of my dependence on God, there's a problem. And I know there's a fine line there, because having insurance is a good thing to have. That's wise. But I'm not sure insurance is wise when it removes our dependence on God completely. Then I think we have to get something in check. So far in the letter of James that we've been looking at, James has talked multiple times about the wealthy. And he's hinted at wealth or rich or people who are rich. He's been hinting along the way. And when you open up chapter 5, it's like he pulls the brake on what he was talking about before, and he removes all doubt of what we might wonder he thinks about the rich. And it could be that the rich is referring to even us in the way that we deal with money in our own lives. Here it says, James chapter 5, verse 1, James says this, "Look here, you rich people, weep and groan with anguish because of all the terrible troubles ahead of you." Now, for those of you that have done a lot of Bible reading, when you see the words weep and groan, what do they make you think of?
Suffering.
Suffering? Because of why? Usually you hear it as weeping and gnashing of teeth, whatever that is. Weeping. James is kind of wanting us to get this like final destruction kind of really bad scenario. So he says, you rich people weep and groan with anguish, this strong emotion, because of the terrible troubles ahead of you. James is saying that if you are rich, and when we talk about rich, I think we're looking at what James is saying about never having enough, never being satisfied. We just want and want and want, and we accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. There's this idea that we're never going to have what we want. And he says, you need to weep and groan with anguish because of the terrible trouble ahead of you. Rich people may not know that there's terrible trouble, but James is saying there is terrible trouble ahead of you. You're moving on a path that's going to lead you to a place you don't want to be. And so there's this warning that he's giving here as he starts off this part of the letter. People may be in denial that there is a doomed future ahead of them, but it doesn't change the fact that there may be a doomed future ahead of them. For example, last week I pulled out my snowblower out of storage. And I went to start it, and the dumb thing wouldn't start. It has a pole, it's got an electric start, and it just cranked and cranked and cranked. So I didn't know what was wrong with it. So I got it in my garage, I got a can of ether, starting spray. And I sprayed it into the air intake and did the little electric start, and it fired right up. And then when I stopped spraying, it died. So the only way I can make my snowblower run is like with a holster full of starter spray. And I hire one of the kids to walk by the thing and spray it as I snowblow. Well, that's ridiculous. You can't do that. So I know I got to fix it because, you know, there could be snow sometime. So this week, as I was looking at my snowblower out there, I heard on the weather report that it was going to snow. A few inches maybe. I could fix it next week. I mean, who can't just brush off a few, you know, flakes? But then I realized that if I don't fix my snowblower, I will actually be the one that causes a greater amount of snowfall to fall in Sioux Falls. Because isn't that how it works? If the snowblower is not working, then it's going to snow a lot. But I knew that if I fixed it, it would just be a dusting. So don't blame the weather people. It was my snowblower. I should have had weeping and groaning for the terrible troubles that were ahead of me. Didn't matter whether I agreed with it or not. I had a situation that I knew I was kind of playing with fire. And I think James is kind of saying this. Like, look, folks. Like, if this wealth thing is your focus, there are terrible troubles ahead of you. And you need to be aware of this. This is a warning to those of us that wealth and materialism and stuff and the amassing of these things and the never-quenching desire for stuff. He's saying there's a warning here. There's a problem here. And he's going to tell you what these terrible troubles are. So he jumps into verse 2. He says, your wealth is rotting away. In other words, nothing's going to last. It all just falls apart. Your car and the rust on your car is an example of that. Your fine clothes are moth-eaten rags. You know, everything wrecks. Your gold and silver become worthless because it's just metals that have no real value other than the value we put to it. The very wealth you were counting on will eat away at your flesh like fire. Wow. And this treasure you have accumulated will stand as evidence against you on the day of judgment. We know that we can't take it with us, right? You know how the saying goes, the man with the most toys still dies. I mean, the Egyptians tried to take it with them, but we keep digging up their tombs and all the stuff's still there. You can't take it with you. And when you die, it has no value. It has no worth to you. It doesn't benefit you in any way. Yet a life of amassing it doesn't seem to hold up much value when that life ends. And so James is saying that this focus of just stuff is not going to be the thing that's going to win for you in the long run. And not only that, but he says, your accumulation of stuff, your life that was focused on accumulating stuff, is actually going to be the thing that's going to stand as evidence against you when you stand before God at judgment. That's a sobering idea. If we stand before judgment, my amassing of stuff is what's going to be the evidence against me. That my focus was wrong, that I had it all wrong, that I wasn't focusing on the things of the kingdom, the things that God wanted me to focus on. I was focusing on on achieving what the world wanted me to focus, and personal pleasure and the lust of my own life, and that becomes my focus. And he says, this is going to be the evidence against you at the day of judgment. For the things that our society desires will be the actual things that condemn us in the end. So he goes on in verse 4, he says, for listen, hear the cries of the field workers whom you have cheated of their pay. The wages you held back cry out against you, and the cries of those who harvest your fields have reached the ears of the Lord of heaven's armies. Wealth throughout history has always had a tendency to oppress. Wealth attracts those that are power hungry. And in power is generally a desire to control wealth and control people with that wealth. And it doesn't matter what governmental system, what economic system it might be, what political system it might be. This is true in all arenas. Power hoards wealth, and it oppresses those that stand in its way. Take maybe like a socialistic system. There's a lot of push in today's language that a socialistic system may be a better economic system. But in a socialistic system, wealth is stolen from one group of people to have power over those that they steal from and power over those that they choose to give it to. But it's the people, it's the power of who gets to take it and who gets to determine who gets it. And it's a control, it's a power system. Even capitalism, our current system, there's a tendency in capitalism for wealth to create wealth and power for a very small, select group of people that oppresses the population through monopolies and crony capitalism. No system is perfect because when greed comes in, it corrupts every single system because people desire power, and in that power, they desire wealth, and they like to use that wealth to control and manipulate others. Any system, any society, any culture throughout history, you look and you'll see this pattern within it. And here, James is revealing that even the rich aren't providing the basic needs for their workers, that they've cheated their workers in some way, and that the cries of the oppressed, the cries of the people who have been abused, maybe that's been you in your work, maybe you've not gotten the raise you need or the recognition you need, or someone's taken something from you. But he says that the cries of the people, that it's gone up and to the Lord's ears, he hears their cries. And this is the source of the weeping and the groaning, because the rich will be judged by what they kept and what they didn't give. James doesn't let up. Verse 5, he says, you have spent your years on earth in luxury, satisfying your every desire. You have fattened yourselves for the day of slaughter. You have condemned and killed innocent people who do not resist you. James is saying the rich have had their heaven. It was heaven on earth. You had it all. Those that don't have as much as someone else, look at people who have more, and you just have to believe somehow in your heart that if you were rich like them, your life would be miserable and their life must be miserable. And that's foolish. Rich people have a blast. Rich people have a lot of fun. They travel. They go places. They buy whatever they want. They see a car, they go buy it. They want a house in the Hamptons. I don't even know what the Hamptons are, but they buy one. It doesn't matter. They have all that they want, and they can have a lot of fun with it. My dad used to always tell me growing up, he says, money won't bring happiness, but it can help. No, it doesn't bring happiness, but just because you have a lot of money and a lot of wealth, Christian or non-Christian, God-fearing or not God-fearing, you could still have a blast. It's not like a death sentence to you. Now, sure, for some people it becomes a problem, but money in itself isn't evil, and you can have a lot of fun with it. You can do a lot of stuff. You can help a lot of people. You can do a lot of stuff with money. And so we need to kind of get out of this mindset that if someone has money, they're evil or they have a miserable life, they can have a blast. But James is saying that if you make your life about the accumulation of this stuff and living it out and just having a good time, you have already had your heaven. Meaning what? Not for the one to come, but you already had it here. You enjoyed it. You did it. You lived it up all the way to the end. When I was in high school, there was a band that I used to listen to called AC/DC. Ever heard of that band? And they had a song that, as I was writing this message this week, kind of, I don't know, it played in my head. I'm a pastor, maybe it shouldn't, but it did. It sounds like this. More volume, please. No stop signs, speed limit. Nobody's gonna slow me down. Let the wheel go spinning. Nobody's gonna mess me around. Hey, Satan, hey, my Jews, hey, I'm in a rocking band. Hey, mama, look at me. Yeah, I just did that. I wanted that on my resume that I played that in a church. But that's this band is celebrating that idea, right? It doesn't matter how I live. I'm living my life the way I shouldn't. I'm on the highway to hell, and like, don't stop me. That's just, I'm going to do it all now while I'm alive, and I'll worry about eternity then. And James is saying that if you do that, you've had your heaven. You've had your fun. You had all that the world could offer you. But when you come to the end, that's going to be it. But for those that have patience, for those that are humble, for those that focus on the kingdom of God, for those that seek mercy and love and justice and forgiveness, there's an eternity, there's a paradise for all of eternity. And why cash that in for 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years of whatever can be bought here? That James says will just be rust, moth-eaten, trashed, worthless. The killing that's referenced, jump back to verse 5 there. The killing that's referenced here in verse 6 is here most likely as a reference of something that was happening during the days of James, in which a wealthy landowner would go to a smaller farmer. And he would take that farmer to court. And it was a corrupt system, and the wealthy landowner's money helped it be a corrupt system that he could win in. And he would take the land away from that local small farmer. Then he would hire that farmer back to work his own land that the wealthy landowner now owns. But he wouldn't pay him a fair wage. And so the farmer, they got his land taken from him and is now working for the landowner, can't make enough money to feed his family. And so the wealthy landowner would give him a loan, credit. Well, if he couldn't even feed his family, how in the world is he going to pay his credit? And eventually he would become in debt to the landowner, and the landowner would take him to something that they had in those days called debtor's court. And in debtor's court, the debt would be applied against the person who had the debt, and they would be thrown in jail or prison, like a dungeon kind of a setting, until they could pay it back. How is that going to work? It didn't work. These people would rot and die in prison. In fact, these people would have to sell their family members as slaves to help pay off the debt. And so this killing isn't so much like, oh, I'm going to kill you, but it's this idea of this oppressive system that really did take the lives of people. But Jewish people would say, in their writings, they would say that if you take away someone's ability to provide for themselves, it's the same as killing them. And so that's what's being said right here. You've condemned and killed innocent people who do not resist you. This is a terrible thing that's taking place that James is calling out to. Verse 7, he says, "Dear brothers and sisters," these are for the people that have been oppressed. He says, "be patient as you wait for the Lord's return. Consider the farmers who patiently wait for the rains in the fall and the spring, that eagerly look for the valuable harvest to ripen. And you too must be patient. Take courage, for the coming of the Lord is near." James is saying here that for those of us that have been oppressed, we need to, is it verse, Andrew, 7? There it is. Dear brothers and sisters, be patient as you wait for the Lord's return. There's this patience that we have to have, but you know, we don't come from a world that really honors or values patience, right? I mean, if I've been wronged, I want vindication like right away. I want justice, retaliation. These are the things I want, and I want them immediately. But James is saying you need to be patient as you wait for the Lord's return. As you wait for the Lord's judgment on this issue, you just need to be patient. And he gives the example of considering the farmers who wait for the rains, because then they're going to get this valuable, incredible harvest. But how hard is this to wait when we feel like we've been wronged? I mean, delayed vindication or delayed justice or delayed gratification and patience are not what our world values or sees as beneficial. But things like retribution and vindication and revenge and retaliation and payback and a day of reckoning, that's our way. I want justice right now. Justice is to be swift. Take them to court. Let's get this resolved. But have you ever noticed when you read the scriptures that God doesn't work that way, that his justice is always slow? You ever notice how you read the Bible? It says it's never swift, it's always slow. Slower than what most people want. Certainly slower than I want in my life. But why is God's justice delayed? You ever thought about that? Because God is love. And God patiently waits for us to see our wrongs and correct them. It's easy when someone's wronged us. We say, God, just like strike them with lightning, right? Let's get it over with. But haven't you been the oppressor sometimes? Haven't you been the one in the wrong or done something to hurt someone else? And God's justice wasn't swift on you. He was patient with you till you came to the point of realizing you're wrong and confessing that sin, asking for forgiveness, righting the wrongs. And as he's been patient with you, he's patient with others, because God is a God of love. And he's a God of grace. He's a God of second chances. He's a God of hope. And he's that for you, but he's also that for others. And we have to let others have that same opportunity. And so we have to be patient, James says, because the day will come when we will be judged. Judgment is something that will come to every single one of us. When will the Lord return? People write books about this, right? All kind of conspiracy theories. When will the Lord return? Do you know what the answer for the Christians should be with that? It'll happen in your lifetime. Do you know that? And I'm not an end times predictor, but I know this. That when you die, 1 millisecond later, you'll stand before judgment before God, and that's when the Lord returns for you and for me. It's not like in 100 years or 1,000 years or another 1,000,000 years. Like, when will the Lord return? In my lifetime. Actually, 1 millisecond after my lifetime. I'll stand before God, and I will be judged for the things of my life. My day of judgment, the day of reckoning, will happen when I pass from this earth to go to the next. And I will be held accountable for the choices that I made, for the ways that I spent my time, for the things that I valued, for the things that I didn't value, for the things that I kept, and for the things that I gave. The day of reckoning will happen in your lifetime, not sometime in some distant future. And I don't know when your lifetime ends, but mine could only last another 2 or 3 hours. Same with yours. I could spin off in some ditch today. Some terrible accident could happen. It might be the last time you ever see me. No guarantees in this life. But I have an opportunity right now to make a difference today. I have an opportunity right now to confess sin. I have an opportunity right now to ask for forgiveness and to receive forgiveness. I have an opportunity right now to change the direction of the focus of things that I spend money on or the focus of my life. I have that opportunity right now because God has been patient with me. He loves me. And he's been patient trying to get my attention. And he's been patient with you trying to get your attention. But the opportunity is now, and you can't just wait for tomorrow, because tomorrow the snowstorm may be bigger than what you anticipate. We only have this moment because he's been patient up to this point. But the patience isn't forever. It's not eternal. There's a day of judgment for each one of us, and that's when we close our eyes to this earth and we open our eyes to the world to come, and we will stand at the Bema Seat. We will stand before our Creator, and we will give account for our lives. I mean, James goes on in verse 9. He's encouraging us. He says, don't grumble about each other, brothers and sisters, for you're going to be judged. For look, the judge is standing at the door. The time has come for us. James is warning the church to love and not to hate, not to grumble and not to fight. And God sees us, He knows our hearts, and He'll judge us accordingly. You and I still have time to right our wrongs. You and I still have time to ask for forgiveness. You and I still have time to do things, to live life the right way, but we don't have forever. You and I do not have the luxury of being able to be lazy about this. But also for those of us that are on the receiving end of oppression, maybe you've just gone through a hard time, not even financial, but someone slandered you, someone's said things about you that aren't true, someone's hurt you in a way that's unfair, that's not right, someone's taken something from you that's much more valuable to you than something financial or material. He says in verse 10, he says, for examples of patience and suffering, dear brothers and sisters, look at the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. We give great honor to those who endure under suffering. For instance, you know about Job, a man of great endurance. You can see how the Lord was kind to him in the end, for the Lord is full of tenderness and mercy. The prophets, they went through great suffering, but that we honor those that go through suffering but still endure. And you may be going through difficult times, whatever that might be. And I want to encourage you, as James does, to persevere, to have patience, to wait on the Lord's judgment, but realize that as it seems slow to you, that's because of His grace and love that He's extending to others, just like He extends to you. God is that good. It doesn't make it easier, but maybe it helps us understand why. But God will bless those that endure. A payday is coming. It's not this moment. So as we end, I kind of have two choices for you. You can either retaliate against those that have oppressed you, and however that might be, and be no better off than the person who was oppressing you. Or you can let God rescue you, to redeem not only you, redeem not only me, but maybe redeem the whole situation, and maybe, just maybe, even redeem the person who oppressed you. The choice is yours. Let's pray. Father God, we do thank You for Your love for us, and we are we're challenged with the choices that we make or the way we live our lives. And Lord, maybe we've all been a little richer than we wanted to admit. Maybe our lives are a reflection of that. But Lord, if that is the case, and if Your Spirit is convicting us of that, we thank You that You've been patient with us to give us this opportunity in this moment. Lord, it would be my prayer that You would help us not to take advantage of Your patience, but to correct what needs to be corrected, to ask for forgiveness where we need to ask it, to line our lives up, our choices, the way that we live according to what You have laid out for us. And that in the midst of all that, that we can find great joy, great peace, and great hope. And that though there are struggles, that Your Spirit will help us to be patient and to endure through those struggles. And look forward to the day that we stand before You on our day of judgment. But instead of a list of everything wrong that we've ever done that condemns us, we would hear the short phrase from You: well done, good and faithful servant. Enter in. May we patiently wait for the heaven to come and pass on the lure of the heaven on earth. We thank You for Your love for us. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, as you go from here, I want to encourage you to have a great week this week. Take opportunities to love others, to encourage people. to realize that yeah, there may be some areas this week that you need to make some changes and some focuses. I mean, with Black Friday coming up, there's a lot of opportunities to make some application of some of the things that we've talked about. What is a need and what is a want? But no matter what, even if you blow it all this week and you're crazy and you're on the news and you're punching people and you're on the 6 o'clock news, we're not going to think any less of you because we're all there. But I want you to know this. In the midst of all of it, God is wildly and radically in love with you. And he's in your corner and he's fighting with you. And so just hang in there and turn little pieces over here and there as you can, and I promise you, you'll be in a better place tomorrow than you were today. God bless you. Thank you for coming today. You're dismissed.